Welcome, I'm Matt Martin sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Virtual currencies, including the popular Bitcoin, got a big boost this week. The Securities and Exchange Commission told a Senate committee on Monday that virtual currencies are a legitimate form of financial transaction. As a result, the value of a single Bitcoin went up nearly 25%. But what is a Bitcoin? It has no centralized leadership to speak for it, but Bitcoin.org calls it an innovative payment network and a new kind of money. In this hour, we'll learn how Bitcoin works, who's using it, and what it might mean if it gets big. Also, Bitcoin is not the only digital currency. There are dozens of others, not to mention an array of third parties that help you buy, trade, and manage your digital money with more anonymity than credit cards or third-party services like PayPal can offer. Could Bitcoin and its competitors allow businesses and consumers to cut out middlemen like Visa and Chase? Could it make it harder for governments to put the squeeze on organizations they don't like, such as WikiLeaks? Or will it be most useful for illicit purposes, allowing drug dealers and money launderers to run their operations without suitcases of cash? And if digital currencies take off, could they compete with government-backed money? The story of digital currency is just beginning, and most of us don't have a clue about the plot. So in this hour, we're first going to be really starting to understand what digital currency is, and then to talk about what its implications might be. There is no CEO of Bitcoin, but there is a community of programmers and developers who have refined it and kept it going. Vitalik Buterin is a part of that community. He is a computer science student at the University of Waterloo, who's currently taking time off to pursue Bitcoin interests full-time. He first joined this community in March of 2011 and has been actively involved in Bitcoin-related projects ever since. And Vitalik joins us here in the studio in San Francisco.
Hello.
Great to have you with us. Also with us on the line from Boston is Tom Simonite. He is senior editor with MIT Technology Review magazine. Tom previously spent 5 years writing and editing technology news coverage at New Scientist magazine, and he's written several articles for the Technology Review about Bitcoin and other emerging digital currencies. Tom, great to have you with us.
Happy to be here, Matt.
Thanks so much. And finally, we're joined by Angela Angelovska-Wilson. She's a lawyer at Latham & Watkins who specializes in alternative payment systems. Specifically, she's at the front lines of issues affecting cryptocurrencies, helping clients navigate the challenges faced by Bitcoin and other virtual currency businesses. And she joins us from Washington. Great to have you with us, Angela.
It's a pleasure to join you.
Thanks so much. So I really want to start by learning about what digital currency is. I think a lot of people are just seeing headlines about Bitcoin and other currencies. I mean, maybe, Tom, you could just start for us. What is a digital currency and how is it different from previous ways of making exchanges of money on the Internet?
Well, a good way to think about Bitcoin, which is really the model for all the currencies you've mentioned, you can think of it as a bit like email. It makes it possible to send money from one person to another across the internet for free. A bit like email, you need a piece of software or a phone app to do that. So you would have a phone app, for example, that stores your bitcoins and I could send them to you. You would receive them in your phone app. And the interesting thing about Bitcoin is that all of that takes place without any central authorities you mentioned, thanks to some clever mathematical tricks. So if you and I wanted to exchange dollar bills, I might not trust you, and I would look at the dollar bill, and if it looked correct, I would say, okay, well, looks like the U.S. government printed that, so I'm going to trust it. With Bitcoin, you don't have to refer to a third party. Your phone app or software program that you're using to manage your Bitcoins uses mathematics to check that the Bitcoins you're receiving are legitimate, and that means that you don't need a lot of the infrastructure that conventional money systems have.
So, but contrast that, say, to something like PayPal, where people... You know, they have a way of making that happen. Just make that contract.
Right. So in the case of PayPal, if you and I exchange money using PayPal, we're trusting PayPal. We're trusting that company to look at to kind of be in charge and be trustworthy and make sure that I'm not sending you fake cash. And in the case of Bitcoin, you don't need that third party. Now you might want to use a third party service because it might make it easier. But you don't have to. And so it makes it possible for people to interact directly, despite the fact they don't know each other or trust one another. They can trust that the funds they're exchanging are legitimate.
So, Vitalik, talk to us. You're in this community of developers and programmers who does work around Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. But there's no centralized organization. No. So what role do you play, and why is, you know, if this is this program that's kind of distributed over all these computers around the world, why does anyone need to take care of it in that sense?
Right. So I guess I'll explain just how the whole Bitcoin development community works. So first, there's Bitcoin. Bitcoin, it's a protocol for transmitting money over the Bitcoin network. But then there's also clients that work over the Bitcoin protocol. So the most popular Bitcoin client and the original Bitcoin client, it's Bitcoin QT, is being maintained by a community of developers that has been involved in Bitcoin pretty much almost since the beginning. There's a group called the Bitcoin Foundation, which supports them. But it's still decentralized because you don't have to use this group's clients. Like, there are other clients. There's, just to name a few, Electrum, Armory, blockchain.info, LibBitcoin, and so forth.
So, Vitalik, for people who don't know anything about this,
right,
what does a client do? I don't even know what that means.
So, a client, you can think of it like a web browser. You have internet protocol, and you have web browsers that let you get pages over the internet protocol. With Bitcoin, you have the Bitcoin protocol, and Bitcoin clients let you send and receive Bitcoins over the Bitcoin protocol.
So, Angela, you, as in your work as a lawyer specializing in finance and this kind of stuff, who's asking you questions about this? Who wants to understand how this works, and, you know, who's gravitating towards it?
Well, surprisingly, there is an enormous interest both in what I would call established clients, so established financial institutions or investors that are looking at the innovations to the financial payment systems that Bitcoin actually brings, as well as emerging companies that are either already or are becoming part of the Bitcoin ecosystem. So that can be the, you know, exchanges, it can be providers of acceptance, providers of security for the Bitcoin protocols in a variety of services that, are kind of growing around the acceptance of Bitcoin into a, what I'll call it, mainstream. We're not there yet, but we're getting there.
Well, we saw this news of the first ATM in Vancouver that deals in Bitcoins. So maybe, I think most people, when they think currency, they think, well, how am I going to use it? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, maybe you could, kind of tell us, Angela. So say I pull my $20 bill out, and I want to say I want to get into Bitcoins. I want to be able to exchange this kind of currency online. How might I start?
Well, the interesting thing about it is that, in my view, the goal of Bitcoin is that we no longer rely on the existing financial system and the need for the real currency, so the real dollars, and instead use Bitcoin as a medium of exchange. Today, most of Bitcoin transactions are reliant on the existing participants in the financial system. So we exchange real money issued by, a government, be it the U.S. government, the Canadian government, the Japanese government, it doesn't matter. So you exchange it. Typically, what happens is most people obtain their Bitcoins over the internet, and in that instance, you are relying on being able to provide your credit card or debit card, and you settle the transaction through the Visa system, where the purchaser provides, their credit card number. Just like a purchase of anything else on the internet, it is exchanged usually through an exchange. Some of the most famous ones are Mt. Gox, and which is actually based in Japan. And then they send you back your Bitcoins on the email address that you register.
There's actually one small misconception there. It's that you actually can't buy Bitcoins with a credit card, unfortunately, or at least it's very hard to.
Not in the U.S. you can't.
Yeah,
and so
right.
Why is that? Explain that.
So because credit cards have this mechanism called chargebacks, where if you make a credit card payment annually and then later on, if you think that you got defrauded or you claim that you got defrauded, you can get the money sent back. And then it's basically up to the merchant to dispute that through the credit card company or the legal system. So because of that, it's very hard to make an exchange between credit card payments and Bitcoins, because if you do it, then someone can just buy $100 worth of Bitcoins with a credit card, get the Bitcoins, and then do a chargeback.
So right now, that isn't possible in the United States. So people who are getting Bitcoins in the United States are starting with cash?
There's actually, it's bank transfers.
Bank transfers, okay, not through credit cards.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a good distinction. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about digital currency today on Your Call. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. Our guests are Vitalik Buterin, who you were just hearing. He is a part of the Bitcoin developer community. Also with us on the line are Angela Angelovska-Wilson, a lawyer who specializes in alternative payment systems, and Tom Simonite, who is a senior editor with the MIT Technology Review. And I definitely invite your questions and comments. This is something most of us are just becoming familiar with, but you may have been seeing it about it in the news. The Homeland Security Committee met earlier this week to talk about the impact of digital currency. Federal judges have said this is, in fact, money that can be regulated in its exchange, just like regular currency. If you have questions, or maybe you have experiences using digital currency, give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK, or you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So I think we are at least starting to understand how Bitcoin in particular works. I understand there are many other digital currencies. But maybe I could ask each of you briefly, why would you say this shift from, I mean, especially if I think, if I'm going to continue to perhaps use these third-party folks who are going to help me use digital currencies, why is this a significant shift to have it organized in this way? Why would you say that people who maybe aren't inherently interested in geeky stuff about the internet, you know, why are they interested in this? Tom Simonite.
Okay. One way to think about this is to think about our existing financial system, as Angela just mentioned. And if you look at that, there's quite a lot of friction there. So it's quite difficult for two people to transfer money that they own between themselves.
There's a lot of middlemen and money to be paid.
There's a lot of middlemen. The banks take cuts. Moving money across borders is very difficult. That's something I've experienced in my own life because, you know, there are fees and all kinds of things like that. And what people are seeing in Bitcoin is a potential for value to flow around much more easily without all that friction. People believe that could lead to many different kind of behaviors and ways of organizing economies. And I think that's reasonable. I have spoken to some people at some of the biggest venture capital firms in Silicon Valley who are very interested in Bitcoin, and they're starting to invest in Bitcoin companies. These are people who more traditionally invest in internet technology companies. And they see a lot of potential in Bitcoin. So Google Ventures, the investment arm of Google, has become involved. Lightspeed, Andreessen Horowitz, the investment arm of IDG, the financial company.
So these big players in venture capital think there's money to be made.
They think there's money to be made. And they often make an argument. They make an analogy with the internet. So they say, if you look at how the internet has freed up the flow of information, that led to all kinds of new economies and businesses.
So Tom,
and if money became able to flow like that, the same sort of thing would happen.
So you talk about this reduced friction, reduced cost in those exchanges. Angela, what would you add to that in terms of what makes this a really important development?
Well, I think that what we have seen up until this point in financial services innovation is that we really haven't had any significant innovation that has moved away from the running on the rails of the credit card, you know, companies, things that were, you know, invented 50 years ago. And, I mean, just recently the Fed actually has a paper and a request of the Federal Reserve of the United States about the fact that payments need to, in the United States especially, need to be sped up, and they need to respond much better in the way that consumers and businesses are paying for goods and services, and how these funds are being able to, you know, move around. I mean, there is absolutely no reason why your check should wait to be cleared for 3 days.
So Angela, that's another point that's kind of just like, it's going to make these kind of transactions move much more easily. So Vitalik, you've given a big part of your life to working on Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. Why is it, I mean, beyond like, people who think they can make money, what's excited you about it that you would really jump in like that?
Right. So, well, I guess I could bring in my perspective from the development side. Is that thing is with Bitcoin is that it's not just that it makes it easier to make a payment with lower fees, but it also vastly reduces the barriers to entry in terms of just creating any kind of site that does anything with money. So, for example, if you look at Bitcoin marketplaces, things like eBay and all sorts of the various clones, with Bitcoin, you can code up one of those in a few hours. So, and also, not even just in terms of the technical speed, it's also Bitcoin is completely bureaucracy-free money. You don't need to ask anyone for permission in order to set something like that up. So people can set up various kinds of services extremely quickly.
So those are some great reasons, and I definitely want to go to our callers. I do want to get back to something that none of you have really mentioned, which is the additional privacy or anonymity that that Bitcoin or its competitors might provide. And we'll definitely get back to that. But first, I want to go. We have a lot of listeners. The line's lit right up on this. Richard in Oakland, welcome to your call. Good to have you with us. Richard, go ahead.
Hello.
Hi, Richard. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Great, yeah. And see, I am just confused because what I'm hearing is that Bitcoin is a separate entity from the traditional monetary system, but then it still is reliant on the old monetary system. Like, you have to buy Bitcoins with paper money, whereas if it was truly a new monetary form, it would be dependent on something completely different. Like you're saying, I mean, it's just confusing to me. I'm trying to say, is there a distinction between the different monetary systems, the Bitcoin system and the paper money system that's regulated by governments?
Great, great question. Tom Simon, you want to take that on?
Yeah, I can speak to that. So, it's true that a lot of the value in Bitcoin today originated in conventional currencies, there are people out there who are doing business entirely in the currency. So building websites, for example, and getting paid in Bitcoin, or paying other people to do services in Bitcoin. I imagine Vitalik knows a bit more about this, but certainly, so the way that some parts of the Bitcoin economy are entirely separate because people are generating and spending value purely within the Bitcoin realm.
All right. Anything you'd add to that, Angela or Vitalik? Go ahead,
Angela. I don't think we have reached the potential of Bitcoin, which is why I think there's so much excitement about it. I think that the excitement is the potential of Bitcoin is to kind of free itself from the existing money and the existing financial system and function completely on its own. And I think that, for me, that is the exciting potential that Bitcoin has, where you travel with your phone to Europe and you don't need to exchange dollars into euros. You're paying for everything in Bitcoin. You can choose to be paid in Bitcoins, maybe, you know, by your employer. I mean, there was a couple that traveled for 3 months all around the world and made a documentary about living only on Bitcoins.
Actually, Angela, I want to. This brings us to our next caller, who's actually William in Belvedere, who has a question right along these lines. William, welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you very much. My name is William, as you noted, and people often call the Williams bills. And I was wondering if I could have put out a bill coin that would have about the same value, real value, because I fail to hear anyone identify anything that the average individual can, at this time, purchase with this whatever it is. And the promise seems to be that someday they will be able to purchase things with them, but they can't now, but let's get them now, because then we'll be able to buy a lot of things. And I'm wondering whether bill coins that I would put out would have the same potential.
I will just answer that argument empirically. There are now currently well over 70 cryptocurrencies. Over half of them are perfect clones of Bitcoin. None of those that are perfect clones of Bitcoin, none of them have gotten anywhere. The only other cryptocurrencies aside from Bitcoin that have any value at all, like, have substantial improvements on top of Bitcoin.
But I mean, the point is that the success of something like this really does depend on many people adopting it. Right now, they say that the dollar valuation of Bitcoin may be $4 billion, which in the realm of things is small.
It's actually around $6 or $7 billion.
Okay, well, it fluctuates a lot, right? Yeah. That's part of the issue.
Especially this week.
Yes.
So, right. So as the hour goes by, that number will change. But the point I think that William is making is if as you say, the barrier to entry in fact is relatively low, can any one of these currencies be strong enough to actually to grow and get that momentum that it would need?
Yeah, so I'll just answer that by saying, like, why would it? Bitcoin currently is perfectly fine, and so far of all of these new cryptocurrencies, like if it's the same as Bitcoin, then there's no incentive to switch to it. No one would.
I'll turn this question to Tom Simon. I mean, this week one thing we're reading a lot about was Ripple, which is an alternative that's being developed by a lot of venture capitalists with their backing. Tom, is that the kind of thing that might challenge Bitcoin as kind of the leader in this area?
Possibly, although right now Ripple's main value is that it is a way to make use of Bitcoin.
Really a third-party thing that handles Bitcoin?
The way they're using it right now is kind of as an interchange point between Bitcoin and other currencies. But to kind of speak to another... So sure. Bitcoin has this huge momentum behind it, as seen by that figure about how much it's worth. And to speak to the other part of William's question, you can... There are many places that you can spend Bitcoin today on the internet. I mean, if I had some Bitcoins, which I don't, I could go out there, I could buy anything from coffee to computer equipment. I could probably find plenty of people in the San Francisco Bay Area who would do work for me in return for Bitcoins. So it is possible to spend Bitcoins today. It's not as easy as spending the dollar, but you can do it, and it is getting easier.
All right. We are talking about digital currency here on Your Call today. And I want to go to our next caller, who is Daniel in San Francisco. Daniel, go ahead. If you could be brief, we're going to have a break pretty soon. So I want to make sure to get a response to your question.
Thank you very much. I'd like to understand about Bitcoin farming and how is new Bitcoin generated? I read an article recently about a game developer who put Bitcoin farming code in his game. And so he had all the users of that game generating Bitcoin on his behalf.
That's a great question. Vitalik, what is that? We talk about Bitcoin mining.
Yes, it's
right?
Bitcoin mining. So basically, Bitcoin, the idea is that in the Bitcoin network, there are thousands of computers that do calculations and to participate in the Bitcoin network and maintain its security. And as a reward for that, there is a rule in the Bitcoin protocol that every 10 minutes, some random computer in the network gets 25 Bitcoins. So Bitcoin mining is the process of participating in the network and trying to get at this reward.
And I want to get back. I mean, we have to go to a break here in just a minute, but I want to kind of, I think for most of us, this idea, why does it need to be mined? Why is this to go out over time? We'll get back to talking about that, just why the specifics of that, and also to the questions about privacy, about law enforcement and regulation that are raised by digital currencies, including Bitcoin. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar here on Your Call. Our guest today, Vitalik Buterin, who we're just hearing from, who is a computer science student at the University of Waterloo and a writer for Bitcoin Magazine. On the line with us is Tom Simonite with MIT Technology Review, and also Angela Angelovska-Wilson, who is a lawyer who specializes in alternative payment systems. Getting lots of calls today at 866-798-8255. If you have questions and want to get involved in this conversation, you are welcome to do it that way. We'd love to have you join the program. This is something a lot of us are just learning about, and we invite you to be part of the conversation. We will be right back. You're listening to Your Call. Be back after this break.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco. We invite you to join today's conversation. Perhaps you have a perspective that we haven't heard yet in the discussion, or a question you feel needs to be answered. Please get in touch. Here's the number, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also email your question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Matt Martin sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On tomorrow's show, it is our weekly media roundtable where we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. We're going to talk about the 50th anniversary of John Kennedy's assassination, as well as new information from the NSA on their surveillance. Also on Monday, we're going to be revisiting a conversation we had with Annie Leonard, who is the person who created The Story of Stuff, talking about the true cost of plastic packaging and who should be held responsible for plastic pollution. Today, we're talking about digital currency like Bitcoin and how they might impact our economy from consumers and how we deal with businesses to bigger questions of how financial regulation and privacy questions like that, which are going to be getting into. Lots of folks on the line at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And actually, I want to go back to our guest, Vitalik Buterin, who works as a developer as part of this community around Bitcoin. Explain, so this program, or this Bitcoin, it was kind of set in motion, and over time, more Bitcoin are, quote-unquote, created.
Yes.
Which I understand by 2030, you max out in the number of Bitcoins?
Well, you actually max out at around 2100, but by 2030, it's basically negligible.
Okay, and why was that built into it? Just so people understand why that creation happens. Why not just say, hey, here's the 21 million Bitcoins, trade them however you want?
Right. So, well, first of all, I think there are cryptocurrencies where people do go for the whole 20, like, here's the 21 million, and I'm going to control, like, how those 21 million are given out. Like Ripple, for example, works that way. MasterCoin is not quite that way, but is similar. And like there are, like those kinds of currencies do get a lot of criticism because people sort of like Bitcoin's sort of aspect of being decentralized and fair and not privileging any specific parties. So they sort of like the idea that there is no central bank. So, and the other reason is it's just in terms of Bitcoin's architecture. So the way Bitcoin mining works is essentially it's a system for maintaining a consensus on who owns how many Bitcoins and on what transactions have been completed. So yeah, so the right, so the issue with that is essentially how do you maintain this consensus? Like generally when we think of a consensus, we think, okay, maybe if you have like 90% or 95%, that's a consensus. But 90% or 95% of what? Like if you say 90% to 95% of computers, then you have a problem because there are hackers that have like access to millions and millions of computers that they've just captured with computer viruses. So if you rely on like IP addresses, like they could easily just take that over.
So Vitalik, I'm actually going to turn this to Tom Simonite to get a little bit. Tom, from your perspective, outside of the Bitcoin community, what was the importance of having that built in as you understand it?
Having the limit built in.
Yeah, how that works.
Yeah, so that really having the limit on 21 million Bitcoins in existence, that really comes back to the creator of Bitcoin, who we only know by a pseudonym, Satoshi Nakamoto, maybe one person, maybe several. This is the person who invented Bitcoin and put the code out on the internet one day, and the community ran with it. Now, he built in this limit of there being 21 million Bitcoins, perhaps for political and economic reasons. Certainly it appealed to some of the early adopters who had what you might call a libertarian mindset and thought that governments shouldn't be able to mess with the supply of money. In the long term, some people believe that may be a problem for Bitcoin. It's built into the system at the moment. It could perhaps be taken out, but it would take a lot of work and a big consensus. And the reason that people economists I've spoken to are surprised by this, because it's in most money systems, like the dollar, for example, inflation, so the money becoming worth less over time, is seen as a good thing, and that's one reason that governments increase the supply of money. And although there are arguments in Washington about how fast the Federal Reserve creates new dollars, few people are calling for them to stop and put a hard cap on the supply.
So speaking of government regulation, we definitely have callers who want to know how digital currencies like Bitcoin could be regulated, how they relate to the government. Let's go to Charlie in Fremont. Charlie, welcome to your call.
Thank you, Matt. I was curious about the whole tax implication. Does this ride under the eye of the IRS and the State Board of Equalization, or are they watching this closely? I know they caught that guy in San Francisco a few months ago who was dealing drugs.
Were you talking about the person who was working on the Silk Road website?
Exactly.
All right. Well, Charlie, we have with us Angelofska Wilson, who specializes in these kind of questions, as and her work as an attorney with Latham & Watkins in Washington, D.C. Angela, talk about that.
Well, certainly, the IRS, as many other government agencies in Washington, D.C., are paying close attention to virtual currencies. As you said, we've had two hearings this week in Congress. We had the Homeland Security as well as the Banking Senate hearing, in which they actually talked a lot about the regulation and the need of regulation, current regulation, and the need for future regulation of virtual currencies. As any new payment methods, as anything new that comes out, regulators are paying a close attention to this. FinCEN, which is actually part of the Department of the Treasury and is in charge of the enforcement and setting of the money laundering policies, has in March issued their virtual currency guidelines that are, basically kind of the blueprint as to what we think the regulators are looking at in the context of regulating virtual currencies. But the IRS and everyone, FBI, the Department of Justice, Department of Homeland Security, FinCEN, and many others are looking very closely of the impact that Bitcoin has on overall for consumer protection issues, from, you know, preventing illicit financial activity.
So, Angela, give us a sense of what are some of the kind of, in the kind of worst case scenarios about what these regulators are concerned, the ways they think digital currencies might be used. What are they most, what are some of the things they're worried about? Give us a couple examples.
Well, the most common example is to combat money laundering and to have ways to gather information about financial transactions that are happening. So the number one concern, I would say, is money laundering, but I think even that issue needs to be put in a context. In the recent congressional hearings, you know, there were some stats that were put forward. So in 2012, PayPal processed approximately $145 billion in online payments.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody really knows, but, you know, we are talking about $6 billion worth of, transactions when it comes to Bitcoin. Again, depends on the valuation and the amount of activity that is happening. So in the grand scheme of, you know, the financial marketplace that we have today, and if we just limit it to the United States even, Bitcoin transactions are small in comparison to, the money laundering potential and activity that happens on the more traditional ways, like in cash or credit cards or other ways.
But the requirements, I mean, if I want to use a credit card for money laundering, there's a lot more scrutiny and a lot more information that government regulators would have over those transactions than they might over a Bitcoin transaction. Isn't that right?
That is correct, and that is one of the concerns that the regulators have, is to whether or not they are going to be able to actually monitor and be able to receive the information about the financial transactions that are happening in these virtual currencies.
And so, Tom Simon, I know you've written that a lot of people, I think, enthusiasts about Bitcoin and digital currencies really like the potential for really private transactions. And of course, that's just what regulators are concerned about, right? They don't like transactions that they can't see. You've kind of said you actually think that ultimately something like Bitcoin won't be that significantly more private once the regulators kind of get their arms around it. Is that what you think?
There is evidence that it's not as private as some people think. Now, if two people exchange Bitcoins directly,
So Vitalik and I do it through Bitcoin directly.
Yeah, there's no third party involved, and so that's hard, very hard to trace. But the way Bitcoin works, one of the ways that they ensure that there's no counterfeiting or spending of things twice is that the computers that maintain the payment, the Bitcoin network, maintain this public log of all transactions. Now, that log, which is a digital file, is not readable to you and I. It doesn't contain names. Doesn't say Vitalik transferred Matt this much. But it does have, you know, say, like, they'll say, you know, this many Bitcoins went from this numerical address to this numerical address. And some researchers at the University of California, San Diego, did some very interesting analysis on that recently, showing that they could map out the thicket of transactions from that and then link back transactions to particular Bitcoin services. And because the Bitcoin services, these payments processes and places where people buy their Bitcoin, because those are companies regulated in the U.S., law enforcement could get their customer records. And so if I was using Bitcoin to buy something illegal and I had obtained my Bitcoins by transferring dollars into one of these companies, it would be possible to kind of trace the Bitcoins back to the transfer company I used and then perhaps reveal who I was. So it's not quite as, it's not anonymous. Bitcoin is not anonymous. It doesn't provide anonymity. It is more private than other ways of transferring cash.
And it does, and one, I mean, one of the things that I think regulators are also concerned about is, whereas when kind of WikiLeaks was at its height, people were trying to give money and third-party services, whether credit card companies or PayPal, actually shut down the ability to make payments like that to WikiLeaks or made it very difficult for people. This provides a way to kind of get around those third parties that are, in fact, more closely regulated, right?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah, it does. Although it's worth noting that the Justice Department representative at the Senate hearing this week said that cash is still the best way to launder money, so... You know,
certainly the one I stand by. We're talking about digital currency here on Your Call. The number, if you want to join the conversation, is 866-798-8255. You can also email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. That's what TJ in Sunnyvale did. And TJ says, this week's San Jose Metro has an article of several gift items one can buy with Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. So we'll definitely post that on our website. And then another thing that... that TJ says is a drawback I see to Bitcoin compared to cash is that there are transaction costs of some sort for facilitating the transaction and online storage. Or, I mean, how can you, in one, TJ wants to know, how do you conduct a transaction without going through an exchange? Is there a way to do that for the kind of average user, Vitalik?
Yeah, so if you want to buy Bitcoins and you don't have an exchange, then there are weekly bi-weekly or monthly Bitcoin meetups in pretty much every city. You go to one, you say, I want to buy 0.2 Bitcoins. Anyone want to sell me some? And you sort of just buy them in person.
All right. So I want to go back. Actually, we also got an email from Donald who says, Matt, to make this interview successful, you have to get the interviewees to answer a couple of questions. One, if Bitcoin has to have a connection to a solid currency, what's the big deal? Why use it? And second, what are the advantages to me as an average consumer to using Bitcoin? So maybe, Tom, you want to just respond to Donald directly? Because I think, you know, a lot of people are still trying to understand, why should I care about this?
Yeah, I have a quick, I mean, that first question is the same one that William raised earlier. And the answer, I think, is that it's true. Today, you know, most people have their money in dollars or some other currency. And so, of course, switching to Bitcoin involves that link. But over time, that link is going to get weaker and weaker. It's already got weaker. And it's definitely possible to create and spend value purely within the Bitcoin economy.
Let's hear from Cynthia in San Francisco. Cynthia, welcome to Your Call.
Well, thank you so much. You know, first of all, I have to say that you know, Bitcoin does have a central authority. Every accounting system does. With Bitcoin, it's simply the programmers that determine the protocol and determine the limits of the currency. That's the first point.
Really,
and the second is a question. In the U.S., the legal system is subsidized by American taxpayers paying in American dollars, and the legal system supports and makes possible commercial transactions. Does our legal system support and make possible Bitcoin transaction, and who pays in taxes for that?
Cynthia, great question. So I'm going to turn your first point to Vitalik, who's sitting here saying, yeah, well, he's mumbling in response, so I want to hear his.
Yeah, that's really not true, because...
What the central authority is.
Yes, Bitcoin has no central authority, because the thing is, sure, there is Bitcoin D, and sure, which is very popular, and sure, there is the Bitcoin Foundation, but once again, it's like web browsers. If the Bitcoin developers decides to make some change to Bitcoin D that people don't like, the rest of the community doesn't have to adopt it. They can just immediately pop over to a new client, and that's the end of it. Like the Bitcoin developers could potentially lose their relevance within a week.
Tom was talking earlier about it might be there'd be a potential for changing this total supply of Bitcoins.
Right.
So if you and three of your friends decide to do that within this kind of Bitcoin community, what's to stop you?
If I and three of my friends decide to do that, then essentially we will start publishing Bitcoin blocks and maintaining the network, and the blocks that we create will be just incompatible with the rest of the system. We'll just have our own little universe into ourselves. So okay. The rest of the network will just ignore it.
Angela, why do you want to address the question about the legal system and the kind of underpinnings of a currency and how that relates to Bitcoin?
Certainly. I mean, one of the interests that the current legal system has an interest is in protecting is the financial system as, you know, we know it today and rely on it. Secondly, preventing illicit activity and such as money laundering. And along with that comes consumer protection. We have actually not been talking about it, but one of the centralized digital currencies that got a lot of press when the Department of Justice shut it down was the Liberty Reserve, and the Liberty dollars were virtual currencies, and they received about $6 billion, I believe, was what was seized. And so I think that there is a very legitimate interest of the government to regulate all of these aspects, and virtual currencies providers as well as others have the responsibility to be part of the financial system. And so for the government not to pay attention to virtual currencies, I think, would be a mistake.
So if this system kind of goes legit, right? It's taken on by the legal system. There's a set of regulators. They find a way to kind of do that. Do you think that, the banks and the credit cards and the PayPals that are in between consumers and businesses one another right now, are they worried about this?
I wouldn't say that they're worried about it, but I think that they're looking very closely at the innovation. There are a number of comments that I have heard with respect to Bitcoin that, are very, very similar to the comments that people used to make with respect to PayPal about 10 years ago.
In terms of what its implications would be.
Right. With PayPal, it was, why do I need it? I can send somebody a check. I don't need to do this. But now nobody questions the legitimacy of PayPal and its participation in the financial system. And so I think that the established financial institutions are looking at the development in virtual currencies. They understand, again, as I said, we in the United States have one of the more ancient payment systems around the world. Our transactions settle much later than they settle in most of the world.
Tom Simon, anything you'd want to add?
Yeah, I would add that Bitcoin is different to PayPal. Even today, if you use PayPal, the way PayPal pulls money out of your account is usually via a credit card or the existing banking system. So the the pre-existing banking and payment system is now just part of PayPal, and Bitcoin offers the potential to go around that. Simon Johnson, he's an economist and was previously chief economist with the IMF. I spoke with him last month about Bitcoin. He's watching it very closely, and he predicted that there would be something of a backlash that the Bitcoin community would face. He suggested that they needed to become ready to kind of fight policy and lobbying battles with the financial industry, who would see the innovation that's happening in Bitcoin as a threat to their income from payments and those kind of fees.
Let's bring on Robert in Palo Alto. Robert, welcome to your call.
Yeah, welcome. Thank you. This is a really interesting program. Thank you for putting it on. I used to advise multinational companies on currency exposure management, and I worked in a couple of trading rooms in London. And one of the things that all these companies are interested in that are going into the emerging market countries is how to hedge their exposure, how to hedge their profits without running up against capital controls, because most of them have capital controls, these countries. So I'm wondering if there might be a potential with Bitcoins in doing that. And also I'm wondering how the rate is calculated when you go on the Internet and buy Bitcoins.
Let's start with the rate question, then get to the question of how larger corporations might use this.
Okay, so in terms of the exchange rate, basically there are Bitcoin exchanges, and on those Bitcoin exchanges, anyone can publish an order. An order might be of the format, I want to sell up to 3 Bitcoins and receive at least $600 per Bitcoin. And then there are also people that say, you know, I want to buy Bitcoin. I'm willing to pay at most $620 for a Bitcoin, and so forth. So all these exchanges have these orders on them, and the orders match automatically. So if someone says, I'm willing to sell for at least 600, and another one says, I'm willing to buy for at most 700, then those two orders match up.
So as someone who's worked in more traditional currency exchanges, does that make sense to you?
It does. It does. I mean, what I'm hearing is that it's the market determines the rate, just as it does with foreign exchange trading.
So then let's go to the other question, Angela. If you want to take that on about, or Angela or Tom, if larger entities, corporate entities who think about maybe putting their money in foreign currencies might say, oh well, maybe Bitcoin would be a place to do that.
I can speak to that a little bit. One thing that was mentioned there was that some countries have capital controls, so limits on how much money you can move out of the country or how fast you can move it. And that's not just something that large companies worry about. Some people have to worry about that too. So in Argentina, for example, where they've had a long history of economic and monetary problems, there are very tight capital controls on moving money. And there has been an explosion in interest in Bitcoin in Argentina, as I understand it, because people are looking for ways to move money across the border and get around those controls. So there's definitely the potential for that. I've also spoken with Bitcoin companies who say they've had a lot of interest in US businesses that want to do business in China. So, you know, everyone wants to make use of the infrastructure and low prices in China these days, but getting money between the US and China can be difficult and it can take several days. So some countries are looking at using Bitcoin as a faster way to route money backwards and forwards.
So, Angela, what are financial regulators thinking about those questions like capital controls, things like that?
Well, the capital controls, at least to my knowledge, have not actually, you know, come to the forefront. The regulators are mostly thinking about the risks within the system with respect to, you know, kind of the things we've been talking about, the money laundering, the consumer protection, and things like that. Mm-hmm. I don't think that there is a wide acceptance of, you know, the use of Bitcoins in, you know, corporates that is warranting the regulators to look at it. But I am sure that as the market expands, that this will be an area that the regulators will start looking at.
Also,
actually, Vitalik, if I could come in, because we've just got a couple minutes here, and there's a question that came in. I want to make sure we get answered, and then I want to ask you guys for some final thoughts about where things might be headed. Very quickly, someone asked, how do you lose Bitcoins, and what's the protection of this system from hackers?
Okay, so
briefly.
Losing Bitcoins, basically, if you have... So, you know, in Bitcoin, there are Bitcoin addresses. Every Bitcoin address has a private key associated with it. You need to use the private... In order to make a transaction to spend from an address, you need to have the private key. So those private keys are stored in an encrypted file on your computer. If you lose the encrypted file or if you forget your password, then you can potentially just lose your private key and you'll never be able to spend them.
And Tom and Angela, there have been examples of these at least one third-party intermediary that went under I don't know all the details of it, but essentially people who had gotten their Bitcoins through them lost them. Is that right?
Yeah, there have been a couple of instances of that. And that really is a symptom of the fact that this is a very early stage. So the people that are interested in Bitcoin, you know, they're setting up these services, which is sort of a bit like banks. People are trusting their money to them. But, you know, the people building these, they're not bankers. They're not people experienced with building financial services. And so we have seen examples of exchanges and other Bitcoin holding sites, you know, getting hacked or going out of business, realizing that they didn't have enough holdings to stay operating, because the kind of the basic competency that exists in financial institutions doesn't necessarily exist in all parts of the Bitcoin ecosystem.
All right. Now, I'm going to ask one last question to you, Angela, and we're going to have to leave it right here. There's so much to talk about. But very briefly, let's say that this becomes a huge thing, whether it's Bitcoin or another one of the digital currencies. Does it become another currency kind of alongside the euro and the dollar and the yen? You know, does it have that, could it have that kind of role?
I think so. I mean, I think that there is a huge potential that it becomes a currency. But I think the beauty of Bitcoin is that it's a little bit more than just a currency. And what I mean by that is being able to do the transactions both in the physical as well as, you know, the virtual world, you know, on the internet, is something that I think is makes Bitcoin a huge potential, which is why everyone's very excited about it.
Well, Angela Angelovska-Wilson, thank you so much for joining us. She's a specialist in alternative payment systems, a lawyer at Latham & Watkins in Washington, D.C. Great to have you with us.
Thank you.
And also with us for this hour, Tom Simonite, senior editor with MIT Technology Review. Thank you so much, Tom.
Thank you.
And Vitalik Buterin, who's part of the Bitcoin community and writes for Bitcoin Magazine, joined us here in the studio in San Francisco.
Thanks,
Vitalik. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. Thank you so much for listening. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss the coverage of the 50th anniversary of President Kennedy's assassination. And we'll also talk about coverage of the National Security Administration. This week, the NSA released hundreds of pages of newly declassified documents related to NSA surveillance. We'll be joined by Open America Project's David Talbot and investigative journalist Tim Shorrock. Join the conversation and call in with your questions on the next Your Call with Holly Kernan and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.